I switch on. Sorry, Ben. Good morning, everyone. I was at a ministers' conference last week, and it was about 100 of us there. You can only imagine what that was like. But there's no shortage of airwaves being filled. But before the service started, there was a display on the screen, which was very helpful. It told us how long it was before the service was due to begin. Something like that, yeah? I'm afraid that only counts down to 4:50 and then goes back to 5, so that's going to bug you, but anyway. So we had this countdown, and it was really helpful because actually, with 5 minutes to go, it was really noisy in the room, and then it got quieter and quieter, and then when it got to the last few seconds, it's just a hush that filled the room. I thought, we should get that for HBC. And then, no, that's what I thought, Ruth. How futile would that be? So I thought, there must be another one on the web which tells you how long since the service started. And we'll get one of those. Maybe get it count up to 10 minutes or something, I don't know. But anyway, we are beginning a new series this week in the run-up to Easter. And in it, we are going to look at some of the things that happened and were said in that last week of Jesus' life. We're quite a low church here, but Holy Week, I believe it's called, or Easter Week. So we're looking at some of those things that were said, and we particularly want to find a way into it by considering the characters of the disciples and the interactions of the disciples and how they needed to learn to be disciples of the cross, which had been alien to their understanding to that point. Now, I don't know about you, but I often find it quite comforting when I look at the 12 disciples. It's yes, they had some fabulous strengths, but they also had their frailties and failings and foibles and flaws and so on. And I must admit, I've been tempted sometimes to think, Jesus, was that the best 12? What were the rest like, you know? Was that really the best 12 that you could have picked, you know? We might be, in our slight arrogance, tempted to think we could do better. You know, I thought I could have got 12 better ones from HBC, perhaps. Lord, forgive me. But actually, when you think about it, we are just like them. And we are also fallen and frail. And it's a great encouragement to us that you've got these... they're not saints, are they, really? They're just regular, down-to-earth people, fishermen, tax collectors and everything. But God does something amazing in their lives, and he recreates them by his spirit into his people. That's not to say God is into changing personalities. Sometimes our personalities need to be changed because they're sometimes misshaped through circumstance. But generally, I think our personalities are okay. And God, we see a range of personalities in the disciples, and that's good. We're all different. But God can take whoever we are and, with his spirit, just bring a maturing and a perfecting, and yes, an empowering that changes us. Now, the disciples needed to be changed, and they specifically need to recognize, as it says here, that they are disciples of the cross. They've been followers of Jesus the rabbi, followers of the great teacher. They've been followers of Jesus the miracle worker, the wonder worker. They've seen all of that. But what they had to come to terms with now is that Jesus was about to die and that they were disciples of that too. And we are disciples of the cross also as Christ's followers. We follow in his steps. He told us to take up our own crosses, deny ourselves and follow him. And through this short series, hopefully each week, there will be testimonies brought to you from people here who... People have gone through or are going through various difficulties. It could be illness, it could be persecution for their faith, it could be trials of some kind. But we're also disciples of the resurrection, and they'll, I hope, be in that a hint of the hope and the peace that God can bring, and the difference that actually being together as God's family brings. Tim, you're going to share today, aren't you? Later on, Tim's going to share today. We look forward to that. But let's first have a look at John 14, starting with the first four verses there. Do not let your hearts be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me. My Father's house has many rooms. If that were not so, would I have told you that I am going there to prepare a place for you. So this is a very different version to what I'm used to. So, and if I go and prepare a place for you, I will come back and take you to be with me so that you also may be where I am. You know the way to the place where I am going. Quite well-known verses. These verses have quite a significance in my family because my grandfather on my mother's side was a lay preacher, preached a lot in church. He actually helped to build the church in his day with his own hands. But then he ended up going to World War I and got caught and was a prisoner of war. And then he fought in World War II and again became a prisoner of war. When he returned, he didn't go back to church. He just said, "I've seen too much. I've seen too much." He was distressed. He was disturbed by what he'd been through. But on his deathbed, he called my mum to his side and he said, "Could you read, please, these very verses, John 14? And she read them. "Do not let your heart be troubled. You believe in God, believe also in me." And when she finished reading, he said, "And I'm going to my mansion now." And he died a few hours later. And it was lovely that for me, this man who I had never met him, by the way, but my maternal grandfather who had been through this profound period of suffering and difficulty and probably doubt as a result of that, I would imagine, actually found God again and made his peace with God. So the disciples also are very troubled at this moment. John 14, it's not immediately obvious. It actually is a discussion during the Last Supper. Jesus has washed the disciples' feet. In John 13, he has just foretold that someone will betray him. Then he's announced that Peter will deny him. And now Jesus begins to speak about going away. He's about to leave them. Must have come as a huge shock to them. You know, these are his followers. They've lived alongside him night and day for 3 years. And now he says he's going away. And one of them is going to betray him. And Peter, who's pretty much the leader of the disciples in some ways, is going to deny him. Well, where does that leave the rest of them? So they're very troubled. But Jesus says to them, "You believe in God?" Of course they believe in God. They're good Jews, aren't they? I'm not sure how much Peter and Andrew, his brother, and some of the others went to the synagogue before Jesus called them. My guess is some of them, not as much as they perhaps could have done, but they knew something of God's law. They would have known something of the Ten Commandments and so on. They believe in God, but Jesus adds something quite radical here. He says, "Believe also in me." You believe in God? Now, this is hours, 15, 18 hours before Jesus dies, he's saying, "Believe in me," because he's God's son. And then Jesus says he's going away, and basically what he's saying is his departure is not a bad thing. In a way, they should be glad he's going away because of what he's going to do, which is to prepare rooms for them. Reference to heaven, of course, going to prepare an eternal dwelling, if you like, for us. I don't know what those rooms will be like. I've heard many Christians talking about their rooms in heaven. All sorts of funny ideas, but it will be better than this. Can you see that little slither in the middle there? Well, if you want to move to Scotland and you have £85,000, that could be yours. I understand it's a bit wider at the back than at the front, but it's only 47 inches wide, 4 feet wide. But, you know, so it's one of the rare moments of humour in the whole sermon, I'm afraid. But our rooms are going to be great. You know, the minute we talk about heaven, we're into sort of, you know, metaphor, aren't we? Because how can we really understand heaven? And, you know, but Jesus is using terms we understand. We have a dwelling place there. We are aliens and strangers here. You know, I know we make home here, but actually we are passing through. This is not the place of permanence. The place of permanence is to come. Challenge is to live like that. So he's preparing this amazing place for us. And so Jesus says, "Don't worry, don't be troubled." And he calls them to trust. But notice it's not this call to trust is not on the basis Jesus is promising them physical security. In fact, as you know, of the 12 disciples, okay, Judas killed himself, but then of the other 11, 10 of them were martyred for their faith. Only John was left on the island of Patmos in exile. So, you know, Jesus certainly wasn't offering them that. What he offers is something actually far more significant, which is that they have a promise of spiritual security, that their eternal destiny is held firmly in his hands. He will take them safely to heaven. And so in verse 4, as we saw at the bottom here, Jesus says, "You know the way to the place where I am going." Now, at this point, they don't really know where Jesus is going. They certainly don't seem to know the way. But what Jesus says is true because he is the way, and they know him. But Thomas speaks up. He says, "Lord, we don't know where you're going, so how can we know the way?" I just want to say a few words about Thomas at this point. I like Thomas, I have to admit. We're not told a lot about him in the New Testament. He crops up a few times in those various lists of the disciples. But apart from that, he only really occurs in three places. First one is in John 11. You remember Lazarus died, and Jesus delayed going. And then when he went, he said, "I'm going to wake him up," which is a euphemism for being raised. And the disciples didn't want Jesus to go because Bethany was just 3 or 4 miles from Jerusalem. Jesus was a wanted man at this point, and they knew that it was practically walking into a death sentence to go to Bethany. And Thomas says, after Jesus is adamant he's going, Thomas says to the other disciples, "Let us also go that we may die with him." And I've always read that as a pessimistic statement, as a defeatist. Okay, we'll go and die too then. But I think I realize that I've misjudged Thomas here, because everything I've read around these verses and Thomas seems to suggest that actually this is a statement of real courage. This is a man who, after the resurrection, church history says he went to India. I'm not saying you need courage to go to India, but he went a long way from Palestine and took the gospel to India and South India. There are communities today who still claim they're in that heritage from Thomas. Thomas also appears in chapter 20 of John. You remember Jesus appeared to the disciples, but Thomas was absent. And Thomas, when he met the disciples, he said, "Unless I see the nail marks in his hands and put my finger where the nails were, and put my hands into his side, I will not believe it." Now notice just how unbelieving Thomas is here. What he's said is actually quite graphic. He said, "Unless I can put my finger into those holes," wherever they were, "and unless I can put my hand into his side," you know, he really doesn't believe. But then a week later, Jesus appeared to the disciples, and Thomas was with them, and Jesus said, "Okay, Thomas, put your finger here, see my hands, reach out your hand and put it into my side. Stop doubting and believe." And Thomas responds by saying just 4 words, "My Lord and my God." And then Jesus says, "Because you've seen me, you've believed. Blessed are those who have not seen and yet have believed." That's us. I guess this story in John 20 is why he's got that title of Doubting Thomas. But I am rather glad that one of the disciples at least struggled with doubt. And even in John 14, he's coming with doubts or questions, isn't he? As we've just heard. I believe that doubt is a universal human condition. I'd love to say to you, put your hand up if you've never struggled with doubt in your life. I'm not going to do it. But I would be amazed if anyone put their hand up. In fact, I'd have trouble believing that person, quite honestly. But I don't just think doubt is a universal condition in churches. I think doubt is a universal condition in the entire world. Because faith is a universal requirement. What I mean by that, let me explain. I coordinate the Alpha courses here, as you know. And in that opening session, one of the things that I'm really keen to get across to the whole group, Christians and non-Christians, is that everybody lives by faith in this world. There can be an understanding that Christians and people of other religious persuasions, that we're the ones who live by faith, and the others, the rationalists, the atheists, they live by something else, hard facts, or science, or something like that. And it's a complete fallacy, it's a complete misunderstanding of the situation, isn't it? We all live by faith. We can't prove God's existence mathematically or in that kind of way, But nor can anyone disprove God's existence. So, as a Christian, I hold my beliefs by faith. If I were an atheist, I would equally be holding those beliefs by faith. Yeah? I've been a Christian for 36 years now, and during that time, there have been periods where I've been tempted to doubt the existence of God. Periods, phases, whatever. I've done 8 years of theology. That was part of a challenge there, but I don't think my experience would be different to most of you. And, you know, there have been moments where I said, is there really a God? Am I just kidding myself here? That sort of thought. What I found in those moments is whatever struggles I might be having with God, for whatever reason, when I look at the alternative proposal that this world is here without him, that life has emerged somehow, and it's developed into this quite simply dazzling complexity. Just look at the human body. Look at the systems at work in the human body simultaneously to just make us be here today. It's mind-blowing. And I've come to the conclusion that, yes, sometimes I may have my struggles and my doubts, but that I lack the faith to be a non-believer. You might say, I haven't got enough faith not to be a Christian. I find when I face my doubts, I very quickly come back to the person of Jesus. And actually, although I'm talking about proof, I've said there's no proof that we can present today for God's existence. Of course there isn't. But that's very different to saying there's no evidence. And actually, when you look at the Christian faith and look at the world, I believe there are compelling evidences to believe in God. For me, the physical world is a massive one. Within our faith, the person of Christ, who didn't just come and give us a philosophy that you can take or leave, but actually proved that and authenticated it and undergirded it with his own life, with his miracles, the signs, with his, ultimately with his resurrection, conquering death. I like what disciple John says in 1 John 1, verse 1. That which was from the beginning, which we have heard, which we have seen with our eyes, which we've looked at and our hands have touched, Jesus, in other words, this we proclaim concerning the word of life. So John had been there with Jesus. So, yes, we live by faith as Christians, but it's not a blind faith. It's not a faith despite the evidence. It's a sighted faith because of the evidence that leads us to God. Coming back to our verses here in John 14, Thomas has these questions. He says, Lord, we don't know where you're going, Jesus, so how can we know the way? And Jesus' reply here has become famous. It's one of the seven I am sayings in John's gospel. He says, I am the way, the truth, and the life. No one comes to the Father except through me. Let's be clear on this. Christianity is clearly and unapologetically centered on Jesus Christ. It's being a Christian is not about a general belief in God or a higher being, a higher power. There are other names for that sort of thing. Theism, for example. That's what that is. To be a Christian means that we believe that in Jesus we have the perfect self-revelation of God. It's in him. In Christ we see God. Thomas here, he doesn't need a map to get him to where he's supposed to be going. He doesn't need a philosophy. He needs the person of Jesus. No one, Jesus says, come to the Father except through me. You know I have a dog, don't you? I must have talked about the dog already. He's epic. I love my dog. Bailey. Bailey boy. Anyway, I won't go on about him. So one of the things having a dog is you have to walk it. And I take Bailey out most lunchtimes if I can. James works through his lunch breaks, but I walk the dog. It's all right. Take the dog out. And mostly around Margaret Road Park. And some of you who live around that area, you will have spotted a group of very committed dog walkers, which I'm now part of. And we see each other almost on a daily basis. And over the last 10 months, I've got to know these guys, mostly guys, really well, which is lovely. And I share my life with them. And I've told them I'm a minister. Now, you know, that creates all kinds of easy opportunities for me. I'm a minister. Anything I say won't surprise them anymore. You know, what did you do at the weekend? Oh, I was doing this and that, and there's a baptism at Northway, and it was great, and, you know. And they expect that from me. They expect to hear that. And actually, culturally, they should be able to cope with that just fine. Yeah? Because our culture tells us, you can believe what you like, it's all right. So, if I'm a Christian, great, they should be happy to hear me. And if their other friends are Buddhists, they'll hear them too, and so on. Not a problem. But you see, when I walk the dog tomorrow, if I do, what if I shared a verse like this with them? I am the way, no one comes to the Father except through me. See, that even in doing that, I've crossed over a line, a cultural line. Because I'm not just saying now I'm a Christian, I'm saying, and you need Christ too. And that is what our culture doesn't want us to do. I will have been politically incorrect. How dare I say something like that? And it seems to me that that is the choice that we have to make. I think I've been tempted into thinking that it's enough for other people to know I'm a Christian. Opportunities will come. And I think I'm realizing that that's not enough, that I actually do need to tell people that they need Jesus too. Otherwise, some of them could go through the whole of their lives knowing I'm a Christian and not realizing the imperative for them. I remember the 80s, you know, I was at university in the late 80s, very late 80s, and it was all about proclamation. You know, apologetics was really big in the 80s, from my memory anyway, because we're all about proclamation, tell people what's true. And then with the sort of postmodern sort of wave, people were saying, well, it's not just about telling people words and doctrine, we need to live it out. And that's true. But I think actually, as good as living out our faith is, that there is a place to get back to proclamation. That people need to hear that they themselves need Christ. And my challenge is, and I say this to myself as much as to you, how convinced are we that others need Christ? Not just they need Christ if they're desperate, because they're going through a tough time and Jesus and the church will help them, but they need Christ anyway, if they haven't got him. They absolutely do. And I fear that we don't understand their need, or we did and have forgotten, or there's been a bit of a cultural slide in us. And I hope as we prepare for Easter that we can really reflect profoundly on the cross, on the fact that Jesus died. You know, I don't think it would have been comfortable at all to have seen with our own eyes Jesus being crucified, but I wonder if we were transported and stood before the cross, if we'd feel very differently about the imperative of this for the world. It's for all. No one, Jesus said, comes to the Father through me. Because Jesus and the Father are one. You know, you can't say, I'll have God, but I'll leave Jesus. You can't say, I'm okay with God the Father, but not so keen on God the Son. Because Jesus said, if you've seen me, you've seen the Father. I and the Father are one. If you know me, you know the Father. And that leads to this question from Philip. Lord, show us the Father, and that'll be enough for us. A few words about Philip. There are a couple of Philips in the New... Well, four, actually. Two of them are kings. Don't worry about those. But there's Philip the evangelist in Acts. But then there's Philip the disciple in the Gospels. And we don't hear much about Philip, the disciple. He was from Bethsaida, same place as Peter and Andrew, so he probably knew those brothers. Philip was the one who told Nathanael he'd met Jesus. He was also the one who certain Greeks, if you remember, came asking to see Jesus. And they came to ask Philip, probably because he had a Greek name, Philip, Philio, I love, Hippos, horse, lover of horses and all that. But Philip mainly features in two stories. The one, John 14, we have today. And the other one is the feeding of the 5,000. Because you remember, there was a huge crowd and Jesus, I think Jesus was throwing the challenge back to the disciples who maybe were being a bit rationalist at this point. How are we going to feed them? And Philip says, if I can find it in my notes here, he says, even 8 months' wages would not be sufficient to buy enough bread. I find it interesting, actually, that Thomas and Philip, in the other places you see them in the Gospels, they're asking questions there or expressing doubts. Maybe Thomas was a doubter, maybe Philip was a bit of a down-to-earth sort of pragmatist and maybe a rationalist, I'm not sure, but it's quite interesting they both crop up together in John 14. So Philip says, show us the Father and that will be enough for us. Do you hear how awkward that sounds in a way? It's like he's asking for the moon here and pretending it's no big deal. Oh, show us God in all his glory. No, that'll be enough. Maybe he's asking Jesus to prove himself, really. But it seems he wants a revelation. You know, Moses saw God on Mount Sinai, didn't he? And Isaiah saw God in Isaiah 6 and said, woe is me, I am undone. But there is a massive irony in this question from Philip, just as there was in the question from Thomas. And the irony with Philip, show us the Father, that is all Jesus has been doing for the past 3 years, showing them the Father. He fed the 5,000, just as the Father fed the Israelites with manna. He calmed the storm, just as God calmed and parted those waters of the Red Sea. Jesus turned water into wine, just as the Father brought that abundance as he took them into the land of Canaan. Jesus gave that teaching in the Sermon on the Mount, just as God revealed his law and his truths on Mount Sinai. You know, Jesus has been doing what we see the Father doing in the Old Testament, or the Trinity doing in the Old Testament. That's all he's doing. And I it's so tragic that Jesus is, as I said, just 15, 18 hours away from his death here, and this is what he's been asked. And I think you can hear the sadness in his reply. Jesus answered, don't you know me, Philip? Even after I've been among you such a long time, anyone who's seen me has seen the Father. How can you say, show us the Father? Don't you believe that I'm in the Father and that the Father is in me? The words I say to you, I do not speak on my own authority. Rather, it is the Father living in me who is doing his work. Believe me when I say that I'm in the Father and the Father is in me, or at least believe on the evidence of the works themselves. You know, this is amazing that Jesus can say words like this. He has lived alongside the disciples for 3 years. Yes, they've seen the teaching, they've heard the teaching, they've seen the miracles. They've also seen Jesus in his full humanity. And yet Jesus, the sinless being, can say, look at me and you've seen the Father. And it seems to me so many people in the world have Philip's question today. God, show yourself. That'll be enough for us. That'll be adequate. Just show yourself. Why are you hiding? Come out into the open. Make yourself known. Then we'll believe. And the Christian response to that is God did do exactly that. He did come out into the open. And yes, some people did believe, and a load of other people wanted to kill him. I want to finish by asking what it means for us to be disciples of the cross ourselves. What does it mean that we follow a Savior who was crucified and then rose again? And I want to say, first of all, just two quick things. First one is, it means something for our personal discipleship. We walk by faith. Sometimes I wish we didn't have to. Faith can be uncomfortable. I don't know why it is that God has chosen this way for us to live, although I do have some ideas, actually. But God, in his wisdom, has chosen that this is how we live, by faith, not by sight. And I think when we face doubt, which we all do at times, we need to bring those doubts to Jesus. I'm sure she wouldn't mind me saying, I was having a chat to Daphne this morning after the first service. Ruel, her son, has been through a terrible time. As you know, he's had two operations. She said at times she was tempted to doubt in God or God's goodness. But she said, I took my doubts to Jesus and he met me. And that's what Thomas and Philip do here. Well, they haven't got much choice. Jesus is right in front of them. But that's what we need to do. If you don't take your doubts to Jesus, where else are you going to take them? Where else is there that's fruitful and productive to take them to? It might seem ironic to take your doubts about God to God, but actually that's exactly what we need to do. Because Jesus didn't just answer their questions. He was the answer to their questions. meeting him, being confronted with him, that is the answer. So let's trust in Jesus. You know, sometimes, like the father of the demon-possessed boy, we might want to cry, Lord, I believe, help thou my unbelief. I think we've all been there. But sometimes we are so confronted by God, by the reality of God, that like Thomas, that when he eventually saw the risen Christ, we just say, my Lord and my God. And the doubt just simply evaporates. So let's be people of faith. And I think this is very important because of the second thing I want to share. You know, if we are not people of faith, if we are crippled by doubt, then we will just be holding on to our faith for ourselves by the skin of our teeth. But we will not have the boldness and the confidence and the assurance to take that to others. You know, if you don't have faith for yourself, have it for those around you. So to be disciples of the cross also means then that Christ and Christ crucified has to be at the center of our gospel proclamation. It's great, as I've said, if people know we're Christians, if they know we believe in God. But as I said, they can tolerate that. They should culturally be able to cope with that, no problem. But we do need to find a way of explaining that they also need Christ with all the love and grace in the world. But they need him too. There's an inclusiveness in Jesus' teaching here. It's not for a select few, it's for all. But there's also a radical exclusiveness that it's through him that the Father is reached. So I think, as I finish, the challenge for us is not necessarily sharing our experience with Christ, of Christ. We need to do that. But I think the challenge is going slightly beyond that and telling people that they need him too. And I think the way we can do that is if we fully grasp the cross, if we fully grasp why it is Jesus had to die. If we get that straight, then the rest will follow. So as we're preparing for Easter, I hope that can happen for us. The cross is described as stumbling block to Jews and foolishness to Greeks, but to us who are being saved, it is the power of God and the wisdom of God. Amen. Dave, thanks.
Is it 5 minutes, Chris? Is that about right? Dave, yeah. It's terrifying standing in front of you lot. I regularly talk to groups of people, but when it's something like this, it's much scarier, isn't it? I've sat and rewritten what I was going to say about six times because I was sure I knew it. But I think I'm going to be much more straight testimony-wise, if that's okay. Dave asked me the week before last, that we were doing Thomas this morning, and he was looking for stories of people coming from doubt to belief. So my Christian home, I grew up in a very Christian home, lovely, supportive parents. I feel a fraud because Chris said at the start, we're going to talk about people who are going through times of struggle and pain and difficulty. I think 98% of my struggles in life have been completely self-inflicted. there's been a couple of tough times on the way from externally, but pretty much it's all my own fault. As a young man, I knew, worked within a church, a large church, as a child growing up, and did have a faith and was baptized about the age of 14. However, for me, it was all about earning it and doing it right. I had a big brother who was taller, stronger, better looking, fitter than me in every way. And for me, a lot of life was about trying to be like Phil. And I think it bred in me a deep sense of unworthiness from a very young age. Not Phil's fault, again, mine, because that was my reflection on it. I think through some of those personal failings, I then looked for distraction in every other sense of the word. Grew up in a place called Romford, if anybody knows it, sort of outskirts of London, bottom of Essex, and there were lots of wonderful distractions in life to be had, and I let myself be drawn into some very rebellious places. And as I looked around the church, as I began that process, I'd read the stories of the Bible, and I just got angrier and angrier that I didn't see the God of the Bible in the people around me. And I think that was my youthful arrogance, perhaps as well as some issues with the church at the time. But I didn't see it. I thought, if this is true, why am I where I am? Why do I feel like I do? If only I could see God. Then it would be fine and I'd follow, but at the moment I can't be bothered. I really fell out with my family. Spending time in my lovely parents' presence was awful. I remember coming to the realization that I hated being with them because it was like looking in a mirror. You know, as soon as I was in their presence, I knew the way I was living was very wrong. So my whole aim was to escape from that. I remember drawing a radius around the house for 200 miles outside of Romford and applied to university everywhere outside of that. So I applied to Aberystwyth, Bangor and Salford. As a result, I think, of the way I was living, I scraped through some A-levels, but only scraped, so I didn't get into any of those. Got kicked into what was then the clearing system and landed in York. The College of Ripon and York, St. John's, stuck on the side of the walls, if anybody knows it. It was there, though, that I met a wonderful community of people. For me, it was first of all, the first opportunity was to delve into all of the pleasures without any concept of the restricting life that my parents placed around me, and got very caught up in those distractions, and life very quickly unraveled. And I had that only increased my sort of sense of unworthiness and failure, really, as I was spending time there. But I did meet on my way through that some amazing Christian people who you could just see Christ in their lives, changing them, changing people around them. And eventually one of them moved into the house to live with me. And he himself was still clinging on to faith by his fingernails. And one of the things that he said to me was, "Tim, even if at the end of the day I find none of this is true, I look at all the people I know and the evidence in their lives, and I know even if I get to the end of my life and find this isn't true, then it's still the best way to live. Because I see blessing in everyone's life who I know who is connected to Christ." And that really stuck with me. What finally brought me into a proper relationship with God was after he dragged me away on a Christian Union weekend away. It was a time when God really spoke to me, and I just held him at arm's length and said, get out. I can't do this again. This is too painful. I remember the feeling of standing on the threshold of faith as a youth, and I don't want it because it's disappointing. I can't go through that again. And when I got back to where I was living in York, I was reading. I don't know why. I've always liked kids' literature. I was rereading The Voyage of the Dawn Treader. I don't know if any of you know that story, but Eustace, the young lad, finds himself sat on a pile of treasure, naffed off with everybody else in the crew, who he thinks is a load of goody-goodies, and he's sitting on this treasure thinking, "This is brilliant, I'm going to be rich." And God told me, "This is exactly what you've done at university. You've left home to live this life of pleasure. And when Eustace awakes on this pile of treasure, he's a dragon." And I recognized that actually I was a completely different person from who I was created to be. And I was so miserable and so unhappy. And in the book, in the story, Eustace tries to take off his dragon's scales. And he rips into himself and pulls it off, and underneath is yet another dragon. And as I was reading this passage, God just said, "Look, Tim, you've tried to do it all in your own strength. Every application that you've made in your life of anything to do with Christianity has been about the systems, the doctrines, the belief, the trying to be like somebody else. And in the end, the Jesus character, Aslan, turns up and says, 'If you want to change, you've got to let me do it.'" And he rips into this guy's skin and it hurts, but out pops this little pink boy. And Christ did meet me in that place as I finally gave up and said, "Okay, it's not about me. It's not about earning it. I am loved. God loves me even after this whole story of rebellion and denial." And I can say that ever since then, meeting that person of Christ and allowing him to have control of my life has been transformational to me and to others around me. And there are times of doubt, there are those times of pain, but the evidence that I have seen day to day in how he walks beside me in all things is just life-changing and a wonderful way to journey with somebody and something. There's a verse that came into my mind when I was speaking. It might not fit particularly, but it's that, "Will your anchor hold in the storms of life?" Does anybody know that old song? "When the storms unfold their winds of strife, when the strong tides lift and the cables strain, will your anchor drift or firm remain?" And it says something like, "We have an anchor steadfast and sure." And it ends up with that anchor being grounded firm and deep in the Saviour's love. We are loved. No matter what we think of ourselves, Christ endured the cross for us. We are deeply loved, never doubt it, and he wants to walk with us and take us from a place of shame into a place of grace. And every time I look back at that journey with Christ, I just see God's grace all over it. So totally don't deserve it. That's why my first child's called Grace.